My name is Gavin Francis, and thank you for listening to this audio recording on the Leases Project. This recording follows on from two webcasts that we broadcast on the 31st of March 2010. Those webcasts are still available to listen to on the IASB website. The webcasts attracted very high participation, and you submitted many questions. So what we've done is taken all of those questions, tried to identify the most common ones that we did not get to in the webcast, and what we're going to try and do in this audio recording is to answer them. Our overall aim is to try and help you become more familiar with this project. Today I'm joined by some of the IASB leasing team, Rachel Nubley, Barbara Davidson, Sunhee Kim and Lily Lian. I would like to stress, though, that the boards are still discussing this project, working towards issuing proposals. That means that the answers given here may change throughout the project. This recording is being made on the 30th of April 2010. I would encourage you to follow progress on the IASB website and also the IASB updates that follow each board meeting. Finally, all of the opinions expressed in this audio recording are those of the individual staff. They do not represent the view of the board. To make this audio recording easier for you to follow, I'm going to structure the session as follows. First of all, I'll provide some very general background. Then I'll turn and look at scope. Then we'll talk about lessee accounting. Then we'll talk about lessor accounting, and finally we'll turn to the proposed transition rules. So let me start first of all with some background. This project will propose eliminating the distinction that we have today between operating and finance leases. That means under these proposals, operating and finance leases would no longer exist. Instead, one lease model would apply to all leases in the scope. And the board has been working on the proposed accounting for both lessees and lessors. So with that general background, let me now turn to scope. And let's talk about the items that the proposals will apply to and those items that the proposals would not apply to. So Rachel, if I can ask you first to talk about how a contract would be differentiated as being a lease versus a sale by the lessor or purchase by the lessee.
Contracts that are purchase or sales of the underlying asset will be outside the scope and won't be accounted for as leases. That would include contracts where title is reasonably certain to pass to the lessee at the end of the lease contract. But it would also cover some other types of contract. For example, contracts which cover the whole of the useful life of the underlying asset and where the interest that the lessor retains in the residual asset is trivial. In addition, contracts where the return that the lessor receives is fixed would be accounted for as purchases or sales rather than lease contracts.
Can we now turn specifically and look at sale leaseback transactions? The board talked about this recently. When is a sale leaseback transaction going to be treated as a sale by the lessee, and hence a lease would be recognised, rather than being treated as a financing?
Sale leaseback transactions will be accounted for as financings unless the contract transfers control and all but a trivial amount of the risks and benefits associated with the underlying asset to the buyer lessor.
And so what are the implications if it's treated as a financing?
If it's treated as a financing, the seller lessee will not derecognise the underlying asset and no gain or loss will arise on the transaction.
And if the transaction is accounted for as a sale and a leaseback rather than financing, what are the effects of that?
If it's accounted for as a sale and leaseback transaction, then the seller lessee will derecognise the underlying asset and will recognise the leaseback. So we'll recognise a right of use asset and an obligation to pay rentals. gains or losses may arise on that transaction.
Okay. And the boards have also talked about the situation whereby the sale leaseback is not established at fair value. Can you talk about that, please?
Yes. If the sale and leaseback is established at fair value, then any gain or loss arising on the transaction is recognised immediately. If, however, the sale and leaseback transaction is established at other than fair value, then the assets, liabilities, and gains or losses arising on the transaction are adjusted to reflect market rentals.
Okay, thank you. Barbara, if I can turn to you, there have been concerns expressed by some about the possible costs and administrative burden of the proposed model. Can you talk about that?
Well, materiality applies to any standard, and so an entity would not have to apply the new requirements for immaterial leases. In addition, there has also been a concession made for short-term leases for both lessees and lessors.
And what is that concession?
The concession is if a lessee or lessor chooses to apply this, the lessee will record the right of use asset and the obligation to pay rentals at the undiscounted gross amounts. The lessor would apply accrual accounting to the lease. And a short-term lease is a lease that has a period of less than 12 months, and that would include any options to extend.
Thank you. Lily, can we talk about, under these proposals, how someone might distinguish between what is a lease contract and what is a service contract?
The boards have tentatively decided to incorporate the principles under IFRIC 4. IFRIC 4 has two principles in regards to when a lease exists. First, the lessee obtains the use of a specific asset, and secondly, the lessee controls the right to use that asset during the lease term.
And following up, so we just talked about when a contract is a lease contract or when it's a service contract. What about if you do have a lease contract, but it has service elements in that? Under these proposals, how would you determine whether or not you have service components in a lease contract?
First, one would have to evaluate whether the lease payments should be allocated between the service or the lease components by applying the guidance developed in the new revenue recognition standard. This is broadly the same as in existing requirements.
And if you cannot make such a determination?
Treat everything as a lease payment.
Okay, thank you. Sunhi, maybe now we can turn to the treatment of leases of land. Are they in or out of the scope?
Leases for land will be in the scope of the new leases proposal. That is, it will be accounted for in the same way as any other leases.
And what about investment properties?
If investment property carries a fair value, it will be outside the scope of new lessor accounting requirements, but new lessee accounting requirements still apply. However, if investment property carries a cost, it's in the scope of new leases proposal, follow the new lessor accounting requirements.
Thank you. Now let's turn to the next section and talk about the proposed accounting for lessees. Under the proposed model, the lessee will record an obligation to make lease payments, and that will create interest expense, and also will recognise a right of use asset that will lead to amortisation. So Rachel, let's turn and look at the obligation first. Can you talk about how options to renew and similar items would be treated under these proposals?
Options to renew or terminate the lease would have to be assessed by the lessee at the start of the lease. The lessee would determine the longest possible lease term that's more likely than not to occur and recognise an obligation to pay rentals and the right of use asset based upon that term.
And what about contingent rentals?
Contingent rentals will also be included within the obligation to pay rentals. Those contingent rentals will be reassessed at each reporting date. Adjustments to the obligation to pay rentals arising from changes in contingent rentals arising in the current or prior periods are recognised in profit or loss. Changes relating to future periods would be recognised as an adjustment to the right of use asset.
So basically, both options to renew and similar items and contingent rentals will be included in your determination and measurement of the obligation rather than being separately recognised.
That's correct.
And a question that came up in the webcast was, what about the treatment of indefinite lease periods? So I think an example might be land.
That would be treated in exactly the same way as any other lease. The lessee would need to determine the longest possible lease term that's more likely than not to occur.
Sunhi, Rachel talked about contingent rentals, and we are talking about lessees, but maybe I should ask you, will lessees and lessors get the same answer for contingent rentals?
No. The measurement could be different because there is a reliability threshold by the lessor on the recognition of contingent rentals because of the consistency with revenue recognition principle.
Thank you. And finally, last question on the obligation for you, Barbara. How is the incremental borrowing rate going to be determined under these proposals?
The lessee's incremental borrowing rate would be the rate of interest that the lessee could incur to borrow the funds necessary to purchase the same asset over a similar term as the lease and with a similar security as the leased asset.
And that rate would take into account the effect or your assessment of things like options to renew that we've just been talking about, is that right?
That's right. So if there was an option to renew for, say, 5 years, the lessee would also look to see what the cost would be for an additional drawdown, what the incremental rate would be for that.
Okay, now let's turn and look at the right of use assets that the lessee would recognise. Can you just talk generally about how that's going to be accounted for, Rachel?
Yes. Initially, the right of use asset would be recorded at the present value of the lease payments, so at the same amount as the obligation to pay rentals. Subsequent measurement of that right of use asset would be on an amortized cost basis.
And what about revaluation of that right of use asset?
The boards have decided to permit revaluation of the right of use asset even if there is no active market in that right of use asset.
And impairment?
Impairment would follow the rules in IS 36, so the normal rules for impairment of non-financial assets.
And finally, presentation.
Presentation would be as a separate line item within the property, plant and equipment.
Now what I'd like to do is turn to the next section and talk about the proposed accounting for lessors. The boards have been discussing two broad models, a performance obligation model and a derecognition model. The performance obligation model is the most developed model, and so that's what I'm going to focus on in this audio recording. Barbara, could you just talk us through the basic rationale behind the performance obligation approach?
So under the performance obligation approach, the lease contract creates a new right, which is the lease receivable, and a new obligation, the performance obligation. The underlying asset is not affected by the lease, so the lessor continues to recognize the underlying asset on its books.
And under this approach, what would be the presentation?
Well, the lease receivable and the performance obligation and the underlying asset are related. So the boards decided that they will present all three together on the balance sheet, gross on the balance sheet, and then net to a net lease asset or lease liability.
So a form of linked presentation.
Yes, so-called linked presentation.
Okay. Lily, maybe I can ask you to talk about the lease receivable and performance obligation. At initial recognition, based on what Rachel said, the measurement would be the same. What about subsequently?
Subsequently, the receivable would result in interest income on an accrual basis, and the performance obligation will be satisfied over the lease term.
So typically on a straight line basis?
Yes, typically. Therefore, subsequent measurement would be different.
Okay. And finally, Lily, maybe we can talk about where the boards have got to on the issue of impairment.
The boards are still discussing this issue, but so far, the boards have tentatively decided that the lessor would first evaluate the lease receivable. Then any impairment to the lease receivable would result in an adjustment to the lease receivable and the performance obligation, with any differences being recognised in profit or loss.
But as you say, the boards are coming back to this issue, so this is definitely one for people to follow.
Yes.
Now I'd like to turn to the next section and talk about transition. Rachel, Is the proposed transition rules is going to be retrospective or prospective?
Neither. The boards have decided that you must apply the new lease accounting requirements to all leases that exist at the transition date. However, there has been some simplification in the measurement of the assets and liabilities that the lessee and lessor will recognise.
And what is that simplification?
Well, for lessees, the boards have decided to measure both the right of use asset and the obligation to pay rentals at the present value of the lease payments, discounted using the lessee's incremental borrowing rate at the date of transition. You would also review the right of use asset for impairment. In addition, there is some relief for simple finance leases.
And what about lessors?
Lessors would recognise a receivable at the present value of the lease payments. That receivable would be discounted at the original rate that the lessor is charging in the lease. The lessor would also recognise a performance obligation equal to the same amount.
So if I understand it, the lessee would be using the incremental borrowing rate at the date of transition, whereas the lessor would use the rate determined at the beginning of the lease. Is that right, and why the difference?
That is correct. The lessee will be able to we'll find it quite difficult to determine the incremental borrowing rates at the original date of the transaction, because that could be several years ago. The lessor, however, should have information about what the rate they charged in the original lease arrangement. And so that's why the difference arises.
Okay. Thank you very much, Sunhee, Barbara, Rachel and Lily. I hope you have found this audio recording useful. As the project progresses, we will continue to update you. Thank you and goodbye.